continuing to explore the Lankavatara Sutra and the teachings of the mind-only tradition. Just to begin with a few thoughts about compassion and the mind-only view. And we've talked about this before in previous studies of mind only. But I think it's really important because we can get into seeing more and more how all these objects of our experience are actually projections of our mind, including all these other living beings, all these other people. Actually, the way we experience them are as projections of our own mind. And it might seem that that is actually, might undermine our compassion, right? Because they're not really suffering people or sentient beings. They're just projections of mind. So don't worry about it. We might think such a thing. So it's important to remember that that would be a big problem if these very teachings of the Mahayana would lessen our compassion. They would be useless, because this whole path is about compassion and unconditional love for all beings and deep care. So one way to think about this is that mind only, that, for example, sentient beings are projections of our own mind, means that there is a non-separation between beings and us. That our versions of people are our own creations of them also implies the non-duality of us and sentient beings. Mind only is all about the non-duality of mind and objects. Right? We got that part about how since objects are of the nature of mind, they're not dualistically separated from mind. It breaks down that separation. That's what mind only is all about. So, if other people, so-called other people, or so-called external people are not actually external, but there's no separation between us and them at all, in the mind-only view, then this is the basis for complete care, and you know, their suffering is our suffering. Does that make sense? And therefore, our liberation can be their liberation, and vice versa. It all goes together. It's the mind only is this realm of like the total intimacy of so-called self and other, or mind and objects, the realm of non-separation. Yes?
Because of the there. He said it's their suffering. That's why it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's kind of tricky because there's these two sides in a way. Sentient beings, others, and also the objects of the world are not, it's like there are versions of them, like you're my version of you, but that doesn't mean that, that what appears to be your suffering is created by like my how can we say it? It's like my projection of your suffering is actually my projection of your suffering, and vice versa. And yet, because we know how to suffer as a sentient being, we know what that's like. We see that and somebody that appears outside herself, but in a way, that's our creation of suffering. So it's like compassion for others and compassion for oneself all kind of breaks down to compassion for any kind of suffering or discontent. What seems to be over there or over here is not so much the issue, but there appears to be discontent. And in a way, this is the kind of weird part, is that that's coming out of our storehouse consciousness. And yet, again, this is not solipsism in the sense that, like, there's only my mind, because it's this very dynamic and really inconceivable realm we're talking about, where everybody, so-called everybody, is projecting everybody else. You know, how can this work? This is where we can't quite get our minds around this, I don't think.
I think where the heart helps is heart and mind are not separate, shin. Then if we can't quite get our mind around it in the realm of compassion, you know, that's where the heart part of the mind can help, because it's so direct, don't you think? Like when you really feel someone else's pain. I mean,
yeah, we naturally
kind of
cuts
through that whole problem of self and other in a way. Like I don't need to. I can't really stay fixated in my story because it's like it's happened. You know, I've recognized that. Oh, your pain is my pain.
The fact that, you know, if sometimes we don't experience others' pain so clearly, but we all have some experience of that, of people who are really close to us, right, where we like their pain is our pain, and that's a kind of, in a way, shows this natural intimacy. It shows how we are co-creating each other, and that we're intimately connected in this way, and you could say that this mind-only story is just is one explanation for why we feel that connection. And you could say, in the times when we don't feel that connection with people who are more distant from us, their pain is not necessarily our pain. That's why we could be cultivating this practice of deepening our understanding of mind only, so that we can meet them. And heart and mind, or you could say that emotional quality of compassion is an aspect of the mind. We could say the heart is one quality. The heartfelt compassion is a quality of the large, all-encompassing mind. It's pretty hard to talk about this in a clear way. Think of how, you know. I think especially this point of you are actually projections of my own mind. But that doesn't mean that there's no, it doesn't mean that you're also not, so-called you, are not actually arising with your own set of karmic conditions, your own storehouse consciousness, and all our so-called storehouse consciousnesses, all our alayas, are all completely interconnected in this inconceivable way. We're co-creating each other all the time. And so it's very easy to slip into one extreme or the other, one side or the other, either that, like, you all don't really exist, and since your suffering is a creation of my own mind, if I just change my view, then I stop your suffering. Which there's some, you know, truth to that statement. But if we just take it at that and leave it there, then I think we start to lose compassion. And then the other extreme we could fall into is that you're not my mind. You are like these beings independent of me, and you really are, the way that I perceive you is really the way you are, and your suffering really is the way I think it is. Mm-hmm. Then that's the other extreme that's also actually undermines compassion too, I think. We often think that that way doesn't undermine compassion, but actually we don't really know each other's suffering except through our own experience of suffering. And something about this, in this intimacy, is how we can help free each other from suffering too, it seems. But again, it's really hard to talk about this part conceptually. Yes?
Would you say it could be related to the golden rule? Does it have a connection to that?
Do unto others as we would have others do unto us. That might be the practical implication. That might be a simple way, without people knowing anything about mind only, anyone can learn the golden rule. Yeah. But we might not, you know, we have the golden rule because people often don't follow the golden rule. Like, well, it sounds good until, like, I want something that, you know, more than I care about the other person. And then I'll kind of fudge on the golden rule. So you could say part of this whole mind-only study is that just the golden rule enough doesn't seem to be enough in this world, actually. I mean, people don't seem to be able to follow it. If they did, then there wouldn't be any wars or crimes or murders or basically any human-caused problems at all. But because we can't quite follow it, we need something more, like a practice.
The religion emphasis is lost, and what we're talking about is the origin, the foundation. Maybe.
Yeah, yeah. We could say this is the foundational origin of the golden rule, of really being able, like if we understood this realm of mind only and all its implications, then we couldn't help but follow the golden rule. Yeah, I think we could say it like that.
So this idea of interconnectedness kind of has that same quality of how interconnected are we really?
Mm-hmm.
Do we just kind of depend on kind of the same environment and conditions to all exist, or, you know, sometimes interconnectedness is talked about as, you know, we are kind of one Gaia, and we're this one, you know, pulsating living planet that's one being.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can, you know, kind of fall on the scale of that.
Yeah.
Well,
at the risk of a little divergence here, I recently was meeting with this physicist in Monterey. We're going to do this little workshop next weekend on Buddhism and science, which we did once before. And we're thinking one of the topics this time he brought up was interconnectedness. He says, isn't that like science teaches this in the realm of ecology is all about physical interconnectedness. And biology is also like within the system of one living being. There's all this interconnected functioning together. And he said, and that seems to be one of the main teachings of Buddhism. And I said, I thought about that a little bit and thought, my understanding is that I don't know about this interconnectedness thing, even though it's something we talk about constantly in American Buddhism. I started thinking, well, where's the traditional basis for that, the kind of in the sutras or the traditional teachings? And there's a lot of related things, but that particular version, I think the very popular American version of almost like an ecological interconnectedness, I think comes from Thich Nhat Hanh. I think he, this is just my current understanding here, is that he has this term interbeing, and he's basing it on Buddhist teachings, but I think it's kind of like his own thing, except for the example I could come up with was, which I don't know that much about, but in Hua Yan, or flower ornament Buddhism, this school based on the Avatamsaka Sutra, they talk about the jeweled net of Indra, and I think that is a similar image for the interconnectedness of all things, that each node in the net is reflecting all other things. But that's like basically a Chinese, somewhat modern Chinese interpretation of this sutra. That's I don't know if it's even talked about exactly that way in the sutra. I think it's from the Chinese founders of the school So, and it's pretty obscure teaching in a way, although we hear about it maybe in America because it's related to ecology and so on. So I thought that was my take, is I don't know if I could talk about interconnectedness from a Buddhist point of view, if we even really have that teaching, even though we constantly talk about it. Except, I thought, of the two examples of this jewel net of Indra and of the other one is mind only. So when you bring this up, I think this is a realm where the way we're interconnected in terms of mind only is we're like co-projecting each other. We're connected in the sense that we are projecting each other. Our minds are projecting each other, and that's the way that we're actually the mind only view of our interconnectedness.
Well, and then just one more sentence.
Mm-hmm.
The scale then goes, you know, is it our minds or our different minds that are co-projecting, or is it kind of one mind that's not shared or. Yeah.
Well, you said, do we depend on our shared environment? I would say the mind-only view would say, no, we don't really have like an external shared environment. That's what's so radical here. We're co-creating this room right now, all of us. There's not really a room before we're co-creating it. And it's amazing how we can co-create it so similarly, right? But that's the kind of, in a way, the shared part is that we have very shared karmic tendencies. Our ability to project a room is very, very similar because we're the same species. Other species project something different here. And all sentient beings also share certain projecting qualities too. This is all according to this mind-only story. But in a way, there's some great intimacy in how we're interconnected because we're co-creating each other. Whereas I would say the other Mahayana school of the Madhyamaka school of Nagarjuna, it's all about dependent co-arising. But I can't think of any examples where Nagarjuna actually talks about this, you know, interconnectedness of all beings in the way that we often do in American Zen. He's using dependent co-arising for kind of a different reason. And same with the Buddha's early teaching of dependent co-arising. You never find in the Pali Sutras anything about, because everything's dependently co-arisen, it means we're all connected. I don't think you'd ever find a statement like that. I think that's coming through Thich Nhat Hanh and maybe others too. And it's beautiful. It's maybe that's one of our offerings and insights of American Buddhism, is to use this teaching of dependent co-arising from the early teachings, and then seeing how Nagarjuna uses this in a way to show how things are empty. He like uses it, dependent co-arising, same teaching but in a completely new way. And then this kind of third level of dependent co-arising, we could say, third function of it, just to show how in a kind of ecological way, something like that, everything is, all of us are connected. So that's the divergence about interconnectedness. But I think that mind only really does show the way of interconnectedness, but not just because we're like, you know, like a Thich Nhat Hanh version of like, well, we were all, we all depend on the air, for example. So the air that we're sharing, like breathing between us, connects us through oxygen. And carbon, we share with it. Our carbon dioxide feeds the trees and they feed back to us the air. That's a kind of ecological vision of science, kind of vision of interconnectedness. But I don't think the Buddhas and the ancient teachers ever thought of that. But we've thought of it. And
well, and that's what happens. We do. We mm-hmm. keep evolving it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't just completely practice mm-hmm. exactly the way that the ancient
yeah.
ancestors
yeah. But we could ask in that vision, even though it's a beautiful vision, is it ultimately liberating? That's one thing we could ask about our maybe modern version of interconnectedness. it's helpful in that it breaks down barriers between us, and it brings up appreciation for the world and each other because we're interconnected. But will it ultimately remove our, all the traces of our habitual delusions? I don't know. It could, or it could be also combined with these different teachings in a way to do that.
Is there an actual difference between each of our individual projecting minds, or are we all just like minds without borders?
Oh yeah, so that was kind of in Patrick's question too, is there one, this comes up a lot in these discussions about Alaya, is it like one mind or one Alaya or multiple? And in a way you could say both. It's like, we've talked about this before I think in this class too, that there's these individual karmic streams that we like, that are, we're unique in that way. Each person is abiding in their dharma position, which is dependent on all the past actions they've done. That's, basically karma is creating, karma means like the intentional actions of body, speech, and mind that we've done, not just in this life, but from beginningless lives, but uniquely are creating this unique, individuals of us. So that's like a bunch of different alayas, a bunch of different storehouses. In that sense, they're individual, but the way that we're interconnected in this realm too is that they're all, although they're all like, in a way borderless, or they're all affecting each other right now. Like me, I'm speaking stuff from my storehouse consciousness, and that's like sinking into your storehouse consciousnesses. So it's one example of how like where our storehouses are affecting each other. So in a way they're all intertwined, inconceivably, inseparable. In that realm, in that kind of conceptual version of like there's interdependent individual consciousnesses, it's kind of a conventional truth of mind only, that there's these individual streams, but they're all, the borders are all kind of melting into each other. But then from the kind of ultimate truth perspective, you could say one mind. You could say actually this conceptual version of all these different consciousnesses interlocking, interwoven, is from an ultimate point of view, there's no separation anywhere. It's in complete non-duality, where actually the storehouse consciousness is seen to be not actually even a storehouse consciousness. This is called the, overturning of the basis, the transformation of Alaya into this like just perfect mirror awareness that's no longer a matter of a bunch of karmic, like there's no actual karma in that anymore. And the section we get to today is going to talk about that karma doesn't really exist from this ultimate perspective, and therefore the Alaya doesn't really exist. And in that realm, we could call it one mind, I think. And we have Zen teachings like Huangbo says, speaking from this ultimate perspective, which Zen people often do, he says, all Buddhas and all sentient beings are just one mind. That's a kind of ultimate statement. But if we just say, well, that's all there is, conventionally speaking too, there's just one mind, it starts to get too like mushy, murky, muddy, blurry. So conventionally speaking, in the realm where we talk about things and are trying to put together a kind of conceptual picture of how this whole projection thing works, in that realm, I think it's helpful to say we have these individual storehouse streams of consciousness that are affecting each other, and the way that one way that they affect each other, that again I find really hard to talk about, is like how we create this, we co-create this Zendo together, is like you could say all our alayas are these overlapping, these are just images because there's no thing there, right? But if we say that like these bubbles of all our past tendencies all kind of like merging into each other, that all those bubbles are kind of like projecting a kind of a so-called external bubble of this Zendo. And we're kind of co-doing that. We can agree on many things about the colors and shapes in this room. But according to this story, our storehouse consciousnesses are doing that. But that's another way in which we're very intimately connected, is we can agree without any effort on very similar versions of this room. Not identical, but very similar versions. And that's also about compassion. We can agree on very similar versions of what it, when somebody's really crying and with their head in their arms and all kind of like sinking into the ground. We have this heart feeling. They don't even have to tell us that they're suffering. We don't know. I mean, it is our projection. And often those things are wrong. They look up and suddenly they're laughing. And, oh, I really thought you were really suffering there. And like, no, I was just kidding. You know, so we don't really know. But we have these, because we share those experiences so deeply, if we saw one person crying in the center here, we'd all create, just like we're creating a similar room, we create a similar version of suffering. We're like imagining suffering. Because from the ultimate perspective, there actually is no suffering either, right? But we're creating suffering, and then we're co-creating compassion to respond to that. Let's go back to the sutra. Which we're having trouble getting through because of things like this. This is all related, though. We're just trying to clarify more and more. So we talked about, we're on page 73, section 9, this third paragraph. We read this part about Mahamati, there's four mind-only conditions for visual consciousness. We won't go over the details, but just where we left off was Mahamati, as with its visual form, consciousness arises together with the minutest sensory objects and sensory material of the various sense organs. So visual consciousness, all the sense consciousnesses, and mental consciousness also, they arise with the minutest sensory objects and sensory material, same thing, of the various sense organs. And with it arise external realms as well. And someone questioned this last week. What do you mean, external realms? And so I think we can put this in quotes, because we know at this point there's just the appearance of external realms. So with it arise the appearance of external realms. Like so many images in a clear mirror, like the images in a mirror aren't really external to the mirror, but they appear like their own things. Or like the ocean when a strong wind blows, the waves on an ocean seem to be like apart from the ocean, but actually they're just part of the ocean. And as the wind of externality, and I looked up this word externality, I think, I don't know if Red Pine is always consistent here, but I know at least sometimes what he's translating as externality is the Sanskrit word vishaya, which if you remember that chart we had of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, are the indriya, the faculties, and then the right-hand side are the sense objects, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, objects of mind. Those sense objects or fields in Sanskrit is called vishaya. So it's a little maybe different take here, that what we're talking about, externality is the appearance of externality is the appearance of colors, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, and mental objects. Those are the vishaya. So the projection of externality is just the projection of objects of both the sense consciousnesses and mental consciousness. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really neat to see that point. Like, what is this externality? It's just his way, Red Pine's way of talking about objects, sensory and mental objects, of which there's six: color, sound, smells, tastes, touchables, and mental objects, which are like concepts and thoughts that seem to be external, don't they? Don't colors seem to be external to mind? So the wind of externality, you can have this like a little different take on this now. You could say the wind of objects, the wind of colors and sounds and stuff, in this metaphor, it's a metaphor that that the colors and sounds and objects of consciousness that seem to be out there are like this wind stirring Alaya. And if, you know, we also have this image of that Alaya, the storehouse consciousness, gives rise to these objects. So it's a mutual thing. It's not like there's objects out there that are stirring up the storehouse. It's more like the storehouse gives rise to the objects, and then they start, you know, they're swirling around out there, and they stir up waves of experience, waves of dualistic experience on the surface of the storehouse ocean. Again, this is very like, it's hard to get your mind around such a thing, right? The storehouse is like creating a wind. It's creating a wind. The wind is then stirring up the waves in the storehouse. It's a dependently co-arisen, like, very dynamic thing. Yes.
Maybe I misunderstood it, but when I was thinking about this, I thought that we create this wind through our predisposition.
Mm-hmm.
For example, yeah, if I see something, I may have desire or aversion,
yeah,
to it, and by that it creates energy around.
Mm-hmm. That's a good example.
The wind.
Yeah.
And another person may be utterly indifferent to, yeah, it, not even seeing,
yeah,
it as,
right,
an object.
Right. No wind for them.
Mm-hmm.
But our experience is getting really windy here. Yeah. We're like salivating, and somebody else is like, can we leave this ice cream shop window now? And like, no, not yet. So like our wind is, and just like you say, we're creating it, and we, in this case, is called Alaya, the storehouse consciousness, which I think I maybe mentioned last week. I think we can say another name for a sentient being is storehouse consciousness. That's who we are. Or we could say, who is ourself? Conventionally speaking, we know there's no independent core essential self. It's one of the important teachings of Buddhism. But conventionally speaking, when we say, like, I'd like to look at the ice cream cone a little longer, that I, in quotes, the kind of like projection of I, what is that actually? What are we talking about there? The mind-only story is we're talking about Alaya. We're talking about our whole collection of all our tendencies that we've ever had that seems to be continuing through time. It seems to be like a permanent kind of fixed self, but it's not permanent and fixed. But it is kind of like who we are. It's our uniqueness. It's the one that wants this ice cream now, even though you don't. I want it. So yeah, we create that wind, and then the wind, what are the waves? I think often in this metaphor, the waves are the sense consciousnesses. And, you know, their objects and faculties and so on. So you could say the wind of the disposition towards liking the ice cream starts stirring up the, for example, the salivation comes. It starts stirring up the tongue faculty, even though we're not even tasting anything. Mm-hmm. That's a nice example. Like the wind of the projection of how ice cream tastes starts making the tongue salivate for what it's going to be like to taste it in a minute. Or not. Isn't it amazing how this different senses interact that way? Yeah, we smell the ice cream, and then the tongue starts to salivate because they're all connected.
It's amazing. I was sitting here very content, and all of a sudden, think it's Ben and Jerry's.
Because of your wind.
Yeah.
It's just a nice image that you can see the Buddha brings up again and again in the sutra, that the storehouse consciousness of all our tendencies is like this ocean of all our tendencies. That's and we can't see them. We get little glimpses. We don't even really get glimpses into that big ocean. We just see the waves. Mm-hmm. It's like we're looking at. We don't ever go underwater. Mm-hmm. Maybe in deep meditation we do some deep sea diving, mm-hmm. but you can't like. Mm-hmm. You know, if you try to like get a hold of anything down there, you'll just come up to the surface again. You can't really like see this deep sea diving. It's really dark, but we can definitely see the waves on the surface when we know that they're coming out of the ocean. They're manifestations of the ocean. So like suddenly, you know, the taste of this vanilla ice cream is very familiar. It reminds me of all the past times I've tasted it. We're having a direct sensory experience of this, you know, taste wave. But that wave is like all stirred up by all the past times we've tasted it too. So this paragraph I don't want to spend too much time on because it's really like I kept reading it over and over and I'm like, whoa. And then at the end, Red Pine's footnote is like, this was really hard to translate from any language. And he said, all the Chinese ones versions differ. Mm-hmm. And he said, I followed Gunabhadra in this case, I think. Like he didn't even know what he's translating yet. So it's just, you can get the kind of gist flavor for what he's saying, but the details, I don't know about this. So he's saying, consciousness arises with minutest sensory objects and sensory material of the sense organs, and with it arises the appearance of these external realms, like so many images in a clear mirror, or like the waves in an ocean when the wind blows. And as the wind of externality of these objects stirs the sea of the mind, we're talking about alaya, its waves of consciousness never cease. Those are the other seven consciousnesses are like the waves on the eighth consciousness of alaya. Whether there's any difference or not among the characteristics of causes and effects, I think we could say this, just any discriminations in the world, I think is what is being said here. Whether there's any differences that we see in the world, of course there are. This is due to a deep attachment to what arises from karma. You know, the way we distinguish the world uniquely is due to our own karmic tendencies from the storehouse, is how I would interpret. Because people cannot understand the nature of such things as form, the five kinds of sensory consciousness function. I would interpret that as like the nature a form is that it's not form. The nature of form is that it's merely mind. But because we don't understand that, we think that it's actually form. Therefore, five kinds of sensory consciousness arise out of the storehouse. Because our sensory consciousnesses are kind of like arising because of delusion. You know, again, a very strong statement, because you might think, well, if we're really completely awakened Buddha, then do we no longer even have five senses? And that does seem to be the mind-only story. Five senses no longer operate for a Buddha in the way that we think of them as perceiving objects and so on. Something else takes their place. It's not like it's just obliterated. But there's this strange story of not only is the basis of the storehouse consciousness overturned or transformed into this perfect mirror wisdom, but all eight consciousnesses are overturned. It's just the alaya is the big one, It's going to happen. But all seven kinds of consciousness, you could say are transformed, but maybe more accurately, they cease to be consciousnesses, or more like they never really were consciousnesses. It's just now they're seen for what they really are, which is like non-dual awareness. And that even the sense consciousnesses become like non-dual awareness. So this is beyond us. How we can, you know, how vision would work in a non-dual way. According to the story, it's inconceivable. Did you have a question?
Oh, I want to divert from what we're doing, but I keep thinking of my dad's funeral and of this person, this body, where my family had all gathered and all these people, and how everybody projected onto this form all these different realities.
Yeah.
And we were all united in the same kind of, you know, consciousness also of grief or loss, and memory of him. But it's like then he is no more.
Yeah.
And just seeing the stillness of this form, like, wow.
Yeah.
What is happening? It's like, well, it's just like, I dreamed it.
No.
I dreamed it all. Now it's done. And
you dreamed his life, you mean?
Yeah, I dreamed of the relationship.
It's
like a dream, because
we're
in it now. Yeah. So in that identity also of just how we identify ourselves as somebody else responds to us, that's also gone. So I think now of this extinction of something that probably never was, different as people experience loss and death, you know, of people they're close with, that it maybe that's what's so startling about it, is that on some level we thought it was so profound and real, and the question is, where are they now?
Yeah.
But yeah, just I keep thinking of it sort of like an enactment of this.
Yeah, well, death can show us a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that you could say, I mean, and this is the story, the Yogacara mind-only story, is that at death, the storehouse consciousness separates from the physical body. That actually during the, even in the, like, the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra, it says that this Alaya storehouse consciousness pervades the body, the physical body. It's non-locatable, but it's very closely, it talks about in that sutra a little bit how this very close relationship between the body and the storehouse consciousness, which is not like some brain kind of thing, that the consciousness is perfect. That's why we have little physical gestures we do. You could say they're unique to us. They're not maybe just the way our body, our joints are built and stuff. They're like the way that Alaya is gesturing. Maybe mudras come out of Alaya functioning through a body. So the story here is at death that Alaya separates from the body. So that's when your relationship is actually Alaya to Alaya, right? Your relationship with your dad was storehouse to storehouse. That's how we're relating now. Well, the body's part of it, you know, because it's your storehouse is animating your body and mine too. So, and we're very body oriented. So we see the expression through the body, but really we're relating like storehouse to storehouse. And a death, like, then that person's storehouse is gone, so we don't have the relationship. It's like, it's not very interesting to relate to a dead body. They're gone, right? So, the story is that the storehouse, in terms of, you know, rebirth is, of course, a big topic in Buddhism, and different schools of Buddhism talk about it in different ways, but the mind-only Yogacara version of rebirth, what is reborn? Each has a different version of what is reborn. And none of them say a self is reborn, because none of the Buddhist schools have a permanent, ongoing stream of self that's reborn. That would be a nice, easy version. Me, I'm reborn. My true essence of me is reborn. But you could say, this is a little divergent, but I think it's interesting and important to understanding this in a way. You could say that all the different schools of Buddhism say what's reborn, in a way, you could say, is the conventional version of self. There is a conventional self, not an inherently existent self, but a mere I that's reborn. And so in early systems, it might be like the stream of five skandhas. the body and mind collection is what we call me. We project a me onto body and mind. So there's not really a me in addition to this five skandhas, but conventionally speaking, what do we refer to? What is the mere I? The mere I, in quotes, is body and mind experience. So those five, or we could really say four skandhas, are in a way reborn. And they're not some continuous stream, they're just arising and ceasing. Some versions, some Buddhist schools say just the fifth skandha called consciousness, the mental consciousness, a very subtle, lineage, we could say, of mental consciousness, arising and ceasing, arising and ceasing. That's what's reborn. In mind-only Buddhism, what's reborn, not a thing that's reborn, but rebirth is just a conventional teaching too. But if we're talking about this conventional teaching, the storehouse consciousness, alaya, is what's reborn. And part of the reason for teaching alaya that the early schools didn't do, part of the reason for positing this strange thing called the storehouse consciousness, is to explain rebirth in a more clear way. That's part of the, people say, that's part of the evolution of this teaching. And I think it does do very well, because if you just say that consciousness is reborn, how does it carry these karmic tendencies? Because we say things that we do in the past life affected this life, things we do in this life will affect the next life. The Buddha taught that from the early days. So how, if it's just consciousness, just mental consciousness, that doesn't carry karmic tendencies. But alaya very conveniently does. Right? It is the storehouse of all our tendencies. And it's not a fixed independent self, but it's quite close to it. And you could say that seething, churning mass of karmic tendencies, like a dark, vast ocean, boom, at death, it separates from the body. Boom, it connects with a sperm and an egg at the moment they meet. It'll be one story. There you have a new life carrying all these dispositions and karmic effects that will come to fruition in this life, right? Which is why little babies act differently. One story for why little babies might act differently. That they're carrying with them these, and we can't see it. And then we have stories. Sometimes people do seem to have memories, and all these things would fit in not very nicely with this explanation. Yeah, you have this little glimpse into that dark ocean of alaya, of something that happened way, way long ago. The Buddha, scripturally speaking, in those early teachings, that was the Buddha's vision at the night of his enlightenment. I see now this amazing show of all these past lives all the way back. And I had, and he gets specific. It's like, with these parents, and I ate this kind of food, and like, da-da-da-da. All at once in this kind of cosmic vision. So alaya fits in very nicely with these stories, whether however we take them, with a grain of salt or a grain of sugar. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sugar? So when you have your talk next week, science and Buddhism.
Yeah. You might enjoy that, by the way.
Huh?
You might enjoy coming if you want.
This point was nice when you did that, the sperm and the egg, the alaya. What do you think science could say to that?
Well, science does try to actually find the point of conception of consciousness, and there's different stories. I don't know, again, I don't know this realm of biology so much, but they use this for arguments about abortion, for example, right? They'll say it's not until the second trimester that there's actually conscious life.
Some people say.
So again, people are researching this all the time, right? So they would say that actually, you could still say the alaya story fits in. It's just that alaya comes in later. That you just have, it doesn't happen right when those meet, but it happens. Like something starts to, like a body starts developing without any consciousness in some strange way, and then there's some moment where alaya links in. And then we have these stories about like 49 days in between lives. So you have like, do we have a disembodied alaya? I guess that would be the Yogacara story. We'd have a, but the problem is that it seems like the sutra never says it quite this way. I think the sutra says more like alaya is always like pervading a body. So it would be hard to have this disembodied 49 days unless you have like a very subtle body. And that's this thing of these Gandharvas, the smell eaters, the soma mushroom eaters. Yeah, this is one of these Buddhist stories, that those are the beings in this in-between state. it gets pretty weird.
Given mind only, I don't see how the body can exist anyway.
So, this talk about
well, the body
being attached to a body which is, doesn't really exist anyway.
Well, the body is a projection of alaya, right? Mm. According to this, the body is one particular and very intense projection of alaya, but that's the mind-only version, is that, yeah, there's not really a, like a physical body in the way we think, experience that
okay,
there is.
Okay, so alaya in and of itself, you're saying, is projecting a body.
Yeah, yeah, in this story, that's how I would understand, is that alaya, one of its main projections is a body, and one of its other main projections is a world that the body lives in. You could say those are the two big projections, and that's the creation of duality. And one version of duality is like alaya creates, boom, there's the body that's like, that alaya seems to be pervading this body, and it doesn't seem to be out here. It seems to be like, that's part of the illusionary creation, is that mind seems connected really intimately with this body and not outside the body. But actually mind is equally, alaya is equally creating a body and an so-called external world. So it's like this divided perception thing. As we talked about before, the seeds in alaya are so, there's so many seeds for a vision of a duality of like me and the world, that's like all sentient beings can do this very easily and amazingly. And function really well, pretty well, in this world. But even though if we function perfectly well with no suffering or discontent, then we wouldn't even need to investigate all this stuff. But it doesn't work that well, right? There's problems. Like when somebody in out there that we create them like attacking us. Why do we do that? We do seem to create like beings outside us that are attacking us, and then we suffer. Amazing. We really believe that they're, we didn't create them, that they're out there attacking us. So then we need teachings like this to say, actually, we're creating them. And if we actually saw that, wouldn't we be freed from the problems that they are causing us? Now again, this is a very dynamic thing, because the so-called they that's attacking me is also, we're related to somebody else who is creating me. And in fact, they feel like I'm attacking them, where I'm not doing anything over here. But they feel as if I'm attacking them. This is suffering, right? It's all these mutual projections from different alayas, like, and then believing in the projections are real. Yes, so...
As we were saying.
whether there's any difference or not among the characteristics of causes and effects is due to deep attachment to what arises from karma, because people cannot understand the nature of such things as form, the five kinds of sensory consciousness function. Because they don't understand the true nature of ice cream, then, you know, tongue and taste consciousness arise to relate to the appearance of ice cream. And due to the differentiation of appearances, Mahamati, you should know that these five kinds of sensory consciousness serve as the cause of conceptual consciousness. That's a nice little point. that, you know, we talked about before, I think, that the direct experience of sense consciousness, we could say, is the cause or condition for the conceptual consciousness to arise. Like, first we directly experience the color, smell and taste of the ice cream cone, and then we have the conceptual idea, that's ice cream, and then we have the karmic effect, karmic conditioning of, I want it, I like it, and then we eat it. And then we have the effect of eating it. But that, in this case, the five kinds of sensory consciousness serve as the cause of conceptual consciousness, the six consciousness. But as they function, they do not think that they are the cause of changes in appearances, which change as a result of attachment to projections that are perceptions of one's own mind. That's just a heavy sentence there, but you could say the gist. The kind of nice part here, I think, is that the consciousnesses themselves don't think that they're causing this world. I think that's kind of a neat twist on this. They don't think, like, this is cool, like, let's make a world now. It's like, they just do it, and we fall for it. But, yeah, they just do it. They don't think that they're creating the world, that it's actually perceptions of one's own mind. And as every appearance changes and disappears, the different realms that are distinguished themselves change. The world changes. Okay, that's enough on that paragraph. You can read it again and, you know, contemplate it as you wish. But now we have a new little topic here. Those practitioners who enter dhyana or samadhi, these are meditation states. The dhyana is actually the Sanskrit word for zen. Zen is a transliteration of dhyana. And samadhi, they mean almost the same thing. Very deep, concentrated absorption, where mind and object start to be less and less separated. Mind and object start to meet, and conceptual thinking is dropped away into this direct experience, right? So those practitioners who enter dhyana or samadhi but who remain unaware of the changes of the subtler forms of habit energy, this is vasana or permeation, think that they enter dhyana or samadhi only after consciousness ceases. But in fact, their consciousness does not cease when they enter samadhi. It doesn't cease because the seeds, bija, of habit energy are not destroyed. It ceases when they no longer grasp changes among objective realms. So this is a cool little paragraph, I think, about referring to early Buddhist teachings about this this concept of called Nirodha Samapatti. Nirodha means cessation, and that it is the word used here for consciousness ceasing. Is Nirodha. Nirodha is also the name of the third noble truth. So this would be part of the implication of the four noble truths. We talk about the cessation of suffering, but the complete cessation of suffering, when you get into, like, the Buddha starts commenting on these four noble truths, it's this very subtle thing of the actual cessation of any kind of dualistic consciousness. So we have these eight dhyanas, that are these, without going into what they all are, they're the, you know, deeper and deeper settling into, you could almost say, like, non-experience. Letting go of more and more subtle levels of conceptuality and identification with anything in particular, dropping down deeper and deeper. This is the Buddha's early teachings, these eight dhyanas in the form realm, and then in the formless realm, and ending with these, and there's all kinds of descriptions in the early sutras, ending with this, the eighth is called neither perception nor non-perception. You might have heard about this. They have these names, like also like infinite space and infinite consciousness, are some of the names for these formless dhyanas. You're into this deep concentration of neither perception nor non-perception. Then there's, based on that very deep concentration, which is not yet like really liberation or cessation of all suffering, actually. But based on that, then there can be the entering into the cessation of feeling and perception, it's called. And which is that a ninth jhana? I think it's not really. It's more like it's this realization of peace, nirvana. And it's also called Nirodha Samapatti. Samapatti means like meditative attainment, basically. It's the meditative attainment of cessation. So one other name for Nirodha Samapatti is the cessation of feeling and perception. And here's a description from this Buddhist dictionary by Jnanatiloka, which has very thorough definitions of many of these terms. So Nirodha Samapatti, or the attainment of cessation or extinction, it says here, also called the cessation of feeling and perception, is the temporary suspension of all consciousness and mental activity following immediately upon the semi-conscious state called sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, which is the eighth jhana, which is necessary to realize this. And upon realizing Nirodha Samapatti, the attainment of cessation, this is also the realization of a once-returner or an arhat. So it's kind of like the goal of the path in early Buddhist teaching. And it comes about through this temporary cessation of consciousness. We could say we're talking about the sixth consciousness, mental consciousness in early Buddhism. So now back to the Lankavatara Sutra. In this case, the sutra says, those practitioners who enter dhyana or samadhi but who remain unaware of the changes of the subtler forms of habit energy, of alaya vijnana, the storehouse consciousness, they think that they enter dhyana or samadhi only after consciousness ceases. But in fact, their consciousness, in this case, we're talking about alaya consciousness, the eighth consciousness, does not cease when they enter samadhi. And only the sixth consciousness temporarily ceases. It, meaning alaya, doesn't cease because the seeds of habit energy are not destroyed. It ceases, alaya actually ceases. True, all consciousness ceases when they no longer grasp changes among objective realms. So, and this is the goal in this Mahayana Yogacara tradition, is the cessation of alaya consciousness, not just the temporary cessation of the sixth mental consciousness, but the complete cessation of alaya, which is also called transformation of the basis. And this ceases when they no longer grasp changes among objective realms. In other words, when all dualistic constructions finally cease. So this paragraph is a special Lankavatara, or mind-only commentary on Nirodha Samapatti, this early teaching, kind of saying that there's more to the story than just this great realization of cessation in the early teachings. There's more to the story here. We also need to become aware of the subtle forms of habit energy of the storehouse consciousness, and no longer grasp at the projections of mind. So in Nirodha Samapatti, the early teachings, the sixth consciousness temporarily ceases. But for true cessation in the mind only story, the eighth consciousness, not just temporarily, but finally and completely ceases. Another way of saying this too is that the alaya, vijnana, the eighth consciousness, it's not really like something that has to cease. It's more like it itself is an illusion. It's a dualistic illusion. So that illusion ceases, revealing what is always the case, which is this perfect mirror, non-dual awareness. Okay, so going on to the next paragraph. Mahamati, except for Tathagatas and those well along the Bodhisattva path, the full extent of the subtlety of the repository consciousness remains completely beyond the ken of Shravakas, Prateka Buddhas, and practitioners of other paths, despite their powers of meditation and wisdom, of samadhi and prajna. Likewise, how to distinguish the characteristics of the remaining stages, Bodhisattva stages, or the meaning of words about wisdom and skillful means, or how to bring to maturity the limitless good roots planted by Buddhas, or how to get free from the projections and fabrications that are perceptions of their own minds. Projections and fabrications is vikalpa prapancha. Vikalpa, again, is this dualistic conceptual thought. And prapancha, we sometimes translate as fixed reference points or conceptual elaborations. They're very similar terms. Here they're combined, vikalpa and prapancha. So this paragraph just follows on the previous one, talking about the difference between Tathagatas and those on the Bodhisattva path who are working with the subtle tendencies of the storehouse consciousness and overturning this whole illusion of duality, versus the Shravakas and Prateka Buddhas of the smaller vehicle, which are don't get into such subtleties. They're just working with the sixth consciousness. Continuing. Mahamati, those who dwell, and those in this case in Sanskrit is actually yogis. All through the sutra, everywhere it says practitioners is generally the translation of the Sanskrit yogi, which is kind of a nice little point since this is the Yogacara school. Yogacara meaning yogic practice school. So Yogacara, yoga, is mind only. Yoga, the yoga of realizing everything as mind. So, practitioners, yogis, those who dwell among mountains and forests, regardless of whether they cultivate lesser, normal, or greater practices, you know, whether they're practicing really well or not, if they're able to see how projections flow from their own minds, if they're able to see this basic point of mind only, that's the essential matter here. They will have their foreheads anointed by Buddhas from countless lands. So in the Sanskrit version of the sutra, this term here is abhisheka, foreheads anointed by Buddhas. In the Chinese, it's kancho. In Japanese pronunciation, kancho means literally pouring or water on the head, or on the top of the head. And it's a term we use in Soto Zen. Kancho is the version of water sprinkling done during ordination ceremonies. And in Sanskrit, this is called abhisheka, which is often also translated as empowerment or initiation. In Vajrayana Buddhism, it's a very important point. Abhisheka in order to receive a new practice and receive the empowerment for that practice, there's this Abhisheka ritual that involves water sprinkling. And there's different kinds of Abhisheka in Vajrayana, in Tibetan tradition. There's these four main types of empowerment or Abhisheka. And the first one involves water, sometimes called the vase empowerment. So we have in Soto Zen this type of Abhisheka, particularly at ordination ceremonies. And empowerment or initiation is to empower the practitioner to practice more deeply, to give the support for really wholehearted practice. And it's a way to receive the blessings of the lineage. That's one way to look at Abhisheka. That the person who sprinkles the water on the head, that anoints the practitioner, baptizes, we could even translate, has received this Abhisheka from their teacher, who received it from their teacher, who received it all the way back to the Buddha. So there's symbolically this, the blessings of the entire lineage back to the Buddha, in whatever lineage this Abhisheka is being received in. Those blessings are transmitted to the person receiving them, and that's gives great support for practice. And we could say symbolically, these blessings are received symbolically through this simple, ordinary act of sprinkling some water on the head with a pine needle or brush or a fern. But in the realm of mind only, symbolically and actually are not separate. Right? Everything in the, we could call a symbol in the mind-only world, since everything we're experiencing is a projection, it's all symbolic. Therefore, to do some symbolic act like this is just as real as anything else we're experiencing. So, a little bit about this Abhisheka from Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who is a good friend of Suzuki Roshi and Koban Chino Roshi, our two founders here, talking about transmission of these blessings. Trungpa says, to receive transmission, it is absolutely necessary to be an ordinary human being, confused, stupid, lustful, and angry. Without those emotional qualities, we cannot receive transmission. They are absolutely necessary. I do not think this is a particularly difficult requirement to fulfill. Everybody seems to have a pretty juicy helping of them. This is quite nice. This is what we need to receive this blessing of the Buddhas. Our emotions are regarded as the wiring or electrical circuit that receives transmission. We could say that we have three wires. One for greed, one for hate, and one for delusion or ignorance. These three form a very busy electrical device that would like to receive transmission. We're hungry for it. We're dying for it. And on the other side, there's the electrical generator, which is somewhat smug, knowing that it is ready to transmit at any time. So we have a good machine and we're beautifully wired. Now we're just waiting for the generator to convey its charge, which in Sanskrit is called Abhisheka. Abhisheka literally means sprinkling or bathing or anointment. It is a formal ceremony of empowerment, a formal transmission from teacher to student. Abhisheka cannot take place unless the necessary wiring has already been set up. And to change our analogy slightly, Abhisheka cannot take place without a good electrician, the teacher, who will know when to switch on the current. And in Abhisheka, there's a sense of destruction, a sense of flow, and a sense of fulfillment. Those three principles of Abhisheka are analogous to electricity in many ways. When we turn on a switch, the first thing that happens is that the resistance to the current is destroyed. Then the current can flow through the circuit. And finally, the electricity can fulfill its purpose. If we turn on a lamp, first the electrical resistance is destroyed by turning on the switch, then the electricity flows, and finally the lamp is lit. In the same way, in receiving Abhisheka, destruction comes first, right at the beginning. Anything that's disorganized or confused and any misconceptions about receiving Abhisheka get destroyed on the spot, immediately. So it's said in the Vajrayana tradition, when it's time to receive the Abhisheka, the instructions are generally to just be totally open and trusting and receptive and put aside all our conceptual ideas about what's going on in the ceremony and what's going to happen afterwards and what we're supposed to do. At this time, we just stop and just rest in openness and trust. We could say the amount that we trust that this is actually working, that the Buddhas are working through us in this way, is the amount of the empowerment that will be effective. So we have a Jukai ceremony coming up, and so at this point in the ceremony is a time to be totally open and trusting and just receive this water on the head. So, regardless of whether yogis cultivate lesser, normal, or greater practices, whatever practice they're working on, if they see how projections flow from their own minds, basically if they realize this teaching of mind only, they will receive this Abhisheka from the Buddhas of countless Buddha lands. And as they attain masteries, psychic faculties, higher powers, and samadhis, they will be surrounded by bodhisattvas and spiritual friends, kalyana mitra, good friends. And because of this, they will transcend the sea of birth and death, or samsara, karma, desire, and ignorance, and the mistaken conceptions concerning the realms of self-existence, of the mind, the will, and conceptual consciousness that are perceptions of their own minds. They'll transcend samsara, karma, desire, ignorance, and all these mistaken concepts regarding the eight consciousnesses. Realizing that everything is perceptions of their own minds. This is why Mahamati yogis, practitioners, should draw near to Buddhas and spiritual friends. So we have the great blessing of Sangha, our spiritual friends, to come together and explore these teachings of the sutras and deepen our understanding more and more. And may it continue. And may all beings open with great trust to receive the blessings of the Buddhas and ancestors upon realizing everything as their mind.